I should say that it's customary, I hope, for organisers not to have to invent their abstracts and titles until the very last minute. And it is true that I did not have mine ready until you had all long submitted yours. And the advantage of organising an event with so capable a friend as Ben is that he can invent your title for you. So I can take no credit for We Never Had Paris. Paris, a poem, was typeset by hand by Virginia Woolf and published by the Hogarth Press in London in 1919. It was Hope Merlise's first poem, first published poem, and it occasioned two very short reviews. The Wasteland was typeset by hand by Virginia Woolf and published by the Hogarth Press in London in 1923. Some months after Eliot's poem had appeared in the Criterion and the Dial, and after Horace Liveright had published it as a slim volume in New York. It was reviewed widely and became rapidly the representative Anglophone modernist poem. Most of us will be familiar with The Wasteland, and few of us, at least until we were sent an anthology for a conference, will have read Paris. Yet, after nearly a century of invisibility, there has been some recent interest in Merlise's poem. Her collected poems were published in 2011, and in 2012, Peter Howarth began his Cambridge Introduction to Modernist Poetry with a detailed reading of Paris. Now, for Howarth, Paris exemplifies a familiar modernist poetics. He says, the cut-up phrases, the lack of syntax, the unclear references, the zipping between an ancient past and modern present, the difficulty, and the tiny sails. So having barely sold, and having almost never been read, Paris, it turns out, may now better represent modernism than The Wasteland, that critical staple and bane of undergraduates. Merlise's poem is typical of modernist poetry, Howarth concludes. Now, Peter Nichols has written that the exemplary modernist poem deliberately invites the question, is it poetry? And if that is the case, then certainly Paris is exemplary, for one of those two reviews complained that Paris is certainly not a poem. To print the words, there is no lily of the valley, in a vertical column of single letters, the reviewer explained, might be a part of a nursery game. It does not belong to the art of poetry. This reviewer concedes that there is method in the madness which peppers the pages with spluttering and incoherent statement displayed with various tricks of type. But nevertheless, that method does not, for this reader, mean poetry. We should ask why. We need to understand the relation between Paris, the poetics which Merlise inherited, and the poetics of her day. The other, much more complimentary reviewer praised the poem, noting that Merlise had adopted the idiom of the younger French poets, of André Salmon and Blaise Cendrars. Paris, writes this second reviewer, is extremely literary and immensely accomplished. One reads it with pleasure and interest, admiring the author's learning and wit, and the skill with which the verse is handled. So one reader finds typographical trickery, the other skillful versification. But verse does not mean poetry, as Eliot was fond of insisting. And many of his and of Merlise's contemporaries looked for poetry in prose, often with the example of French poets in mind, from Baudelaire onwards. The relations between verse, poetry, and prose, and the significance or insignificance of typography, were problems of some moment. In the late 1910s and early 1920s, many British and American critics lamented, for instance, as A.R. Orage put it, that the mechanical devices of free verse were merely typographical. Others defended free verse when, as Harold Munro wrote, its rhythms were strong enough to warrant the typographical device of the division into lines. So the visual presentation of the work, for many readers, was subordinate to its oral qualities. But the idiom of the younger French poets, and even of Mallarmé, dead for 20 years, liberates typography from its subordination to sound. Apollinaire's Calligrams, published a year earlier in 1918, are a good example. And there are comparable instances of graphic iconicity in Paris. It has been suggested that the vertical line of letters represents the workers who marched in a mass strike in Paris on the 1st of May 1919, and that the vertical line represents the stalk of the lily of the valley, customarily sold on the 1st of May to give to friends or lovers, but not for sale that year because of the strike. It has been suggested that the visual array of an earlier passage on the Tuileries mimics the layout of those gardens. And it's true, too, that some of Apollinaire's poems incorporate short iconic sections within a larger frame of non-iconic free verse. This does not seem to me to get us very far in deciding the relation between Paris and the poetics of its time, or between the poetics of Paris and its historical moment. Having praised Merlise's handling of the verse, that second reviewer quotes an exemplary or illustrative passage. "These lines illustrate Miss Merlise's qualities and defects, her clear, witty vision, and the quite superfluous pedantry, which so often comes shutting down heavily and darkly across it." Certainly something changes whether or not we would want to characterize as superfluous pedantry the shift from short line to long line, from metaphor to simile, from apposition to polysyndeton, and from a few simple adjectives to tumbling compound adjectives. More importantly, the reviewer has misnamed Merlise's words, for in the original publication, prose comes shutting down on verse. The line beginning "that one with broad-brimmed hat" is a long line running over the margin. The line beginning "they are black" is not a line at all, but a prose paragraph. Assuming that she or he was provided with a copy of the original, or an accurate copy of the original, the typesetter for the Athenaeum seems to have missed this detail, as well as attempting, helpfully, to give some order to that tumbling polysyndeton with an unwarranted comma after two-dimensional. So really what we want to praise, if praise is in order, is the skill with which verse and prose are handled together. Now, however we describe the movement between lines here, between paragraphs and between line and paragraph, I want to suggest that the movement is essential. Paris is a poem which seems to begin as the account of a journey across the city, registering a speaker's encounters with people and places. In time, it comes to seem the interior monologue or phantasmagoria of a speaker ranging across Paris in her imagination as memories and associations crowd in upon present stimuli, and as the sequence of places mentioned can no longer plausibly represent an actual itinerary. I'm not actually sure that it's important to decide between these explanations for the words upon the page, and I'm not even sure that it's necessary to insist on a speaker as the source of or medium for all of those words, though the suggestion is strong. The movement of the poetry is more interesting, as, for example, on the first page. So a holophrase, as you might already know, is a single word used to express a combination of ideas. And the term holophrase was especially important to Jane Ellen Harrison, the Cambridge classicist with whom Merlise had a long relationship. Nord-Sud was the name of a Paris metro line running from Montmartre to Montparnasse, as well as the name of the company which ran this and one other line. Rue de Bach, Solferino, and Chambre de Debouté, and Concorde are stations on the Nord-Sud line, though the names of the stations in the poem run from south to north. So there is the suggestion that the movement of Merlise's words registers the experience of a traveller heading north on the metro from Rue de Bach under the Seine to Concorde. The route of the Nord-Sud line zigzags east and west as it makes this journey, and zigzag was a brand of cigarette paper advertised with the head of a Zouave or Algerian soldier. The movement between France and Algeria is also a movement between Nord and Sud, and it's repeated and extended throughout the poem. Lion Noir was a brand of shoe polish. Cacao Blücke, a brand of drinking chocolate. These presumably are advertisements encountered on the metro. The soldier, the polish, and the silhouette on the chocolate advertisement then suggest black-figured Etruscan pottery. And presumably the text of the advertisements is capitalized to register this encounter with the words as text rather than speech, so that a little later, when someone asks the speaker whether she would like to disembark, the question is italicized. Vous descendez, madame. And so we proceed, an associative journey paralleling a physical journey. One might call this a movement in which external stimuli generate internal reverie, and in which internal reverie is in turn given new momentum by further immediate stimuli. But the selection of materials resists this reading to a considerable extent. Nothing appears here without having already been incorporated into that network of associations. So the poem does not sustain a dualism of inner and outer, and it is not straightforwardly an interior monologue. Nor does it seem straightforwardly the sequential record of a journey. The first three stations, for instance, are grouped together like the three advertisements, and we are invited to consider the network formed by the connotations of their names. You might say, we journey between Zigzag and Lion Noir just as we journey between Solferino Dubonnet and Chambre de Debouté. The first three stations are aligned by a common indentation, as are the three advertisements. When Dubonnet appears again, it is aligned with those earlier advertisements too. Across this page and throughout the poem, the degree of indentation varies, suggesting at a local level logical relations, groupings, but also seeming more generally to obey a rough centre alignment. Since many of these words seem snippets of found text, and since others appear in isolated phrases, we should ask, I think, how meaningful it is to call these lines of verse, rather than, say, portions of language arrayed on the page. Very few of Merlise's lines confirm their quality as verse by sounding an echo of an established metrical form, in the way in which Eliot famously suggests that the ghost of some simple metre should lurk behind the arras in even the freest free verse. And you will have already seen that the line beginning The Scarlet Woman, helpfully amended in Virginia Woolf's own handwriting, is not in fact a line but a paragraph, not verse but prose. In contrast, Brekek-kek-kek-coax-coax, we are passing under the Seine, does seem to be verse of a sort, since its unpunctuated splicing of a description of the metro journey with the chorus of the frogs from Aristophanes' play emphasizes the non-coincidence of verse unit and syntactical unit, which might be said to constitute verse. But the movement of the poetry is significant because the moment of the poem, the moment captured in that movement, is not the lived instant of an individual on the metro, or in a square, or on the quays of the Seine. As the poem ranges across the city And between the present and the past, that present expands. Paris is set, so to speak, in and across the spring of 1919. Being spring, poplars bud and butterflies dance their ballet, as at the bottom here. But this was also the spring of the Paris Peace Conference, culminating on the 29th of June with the signing of the Treaty of Versailles. Here we have David Lloyd George, Vittorio Emanuele Orlando, Georges Clemenceau, and Woodrow Wilson. We have seen that the poem refers as well to the May Day strike, during which the army opened fire on demonstrators, injuring 600. A passing reference to Émile Cottin means that the poem's moment comes after the 19th of February, for on that day the anarchist Cottin attempted to assassinate Clemenceau, the French Prime Minister. The poem mentions Shrove Tuesday, which fell on the 4th of March, and Easter, which fell on the 20th of April. Elsewhere, it anticipates a pilgrimage in the Camargue, which is going to happen on the 23rd of May. More generally, the Great War looms over the poem. Widows lament while other women collect donations for victims. The Pietà of Villeneuve-les-Avignon, Manet's Olympia, and the other paintings mentioned here have just been returned to the Louvre, having spent the war in underground storage. Elsewhere, a reference to a mujik, or Russian peasant, reminds us of the Russian Civil War. In this way, political events, religious celebrations, and the rebirth of spring are continually counterpointed. So the poem's moment is not an individual's lived instant, but a span of weeks and months collectively experienced. Generically, then, Paris is an occasional poem. Its broad collective moment changes the meaning of the movement of the words. And when I say that this is the poem's present, I mean it quite literally. The present tense encompasses both the speaker's lived instant, as, for instance, we are passing under the Seine, and the many other events described, both momentary and ongoing. President Wilson grins like a dog and runs about the city, sniffing with innocent enjoyment the diluvial urine of Gargantua. In fact, because the poem frames that broad collective moment in the present tense, it is tempting to understand we are passing under the Seine not, or not only, as uttered by a passenger on a metro train at the very moment it passes under the river, but as a figure for the city of Paris or for post-war Europe in the spring of 1919. This helps us to understand the relation between the poetics of Paris and its historical moment, and between Paris and the poetics of its time. As an occasional poem, Paris is, one might say, rather more like Yeats's 1919 than Eliot's The Wasteland. Though Yeats's moment is much broader, a year rather than a season, and Yeats gives no particulars, there are no specific dates in 1919. Of course, as Yeats's sequence is also a kind of bravura technical display, each section a pointed reworking of some traditional verse form. Merlise's poetry shuttles, as we have seen, from verse to prose, whether blithely or awkwardly. This is not, as that reviewer suggests, a shuttling between clear, witty vision and superfluous pedantry, nor is it a shuttling between poetry and commentary. But while the lines of verse tend to limit and divide, the prose paragraphs do allow a length of statement, an accumulation of detail, a freedom to follow the thought through. And it is important to remember that these are not the essential qualities of verse and prose as such, but are qualities developed by this individual poem. They do not have these qualities 4 years later in Ford's Mr. Bosphorus and the Muses or Williams's Spring and All. So I want to suggest that the poetics of Paris is a poetics of the occasion, and specifically of a contingent and open temporality. In the movement of the poem, neither verse nor prose, nor even a clear distinction between verse and prose, is necessary or compulsory. In contrast, Whatever future the Wasteland or 1919 may anticipate, everything which happens in those poems happens as verse. And though Apollinaire also combines free verse, varied indentation, and graphic iconicity, he does not put that synthesis to the representation of a specific historical moment collectively experienced. In this sense, Paris is not at all exemplary, it is singular. So too, arguably, was the spring of 1919 in Paris, a moment following unprecedented catastrophe, a moment which would determine the future of a generation, and a moment of acute uncertainty. Now, Merlise's poem never speaks directly of those high stakes. Wilson runs about the city like a dog, and workers at cafe tables chat intermittently about a trained seal performing at the Nouveau Cirque and about the attempted assassination of Clemenceau. But the historical experience is registered in the technique. The thought of Wilson running about the city like a dog is a particular occasion. It determines its specific mode of presentation. The same is true of "Like Duncan, they slept well." Aligned with those paintings, recently resurrected from storage, this allusion to Macbeth figures those paintings as the murdered Scottish king and recalls the war dead who will not return from subterranean sleep, so that the grim irony occasions a curt, short line. Throughout the poem, distracted digression and taut imagism, pathetic qualification and sudden lyricism register the contingent occasion, as do graphic iconicity, found text, 8 bars of musical score, and indistinction between verse and prose. Howarth is right to point out how much Paris shares with the modernist poetics we know so well, and Paris clearly participates in early 20th century debates about and experiments with typographical trickery, the borderline between verse and prose, and the concept of poetry itself. But there is no modernist equivalent to its agile, responsive, open technique. It's precisely in that technique that a poetics most acutely meets and makes a history. Thank you.